The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Pat Perry from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Work and Money section of the News and Observer. Today's reading of Money Matters is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. Today's stories include What Are Reverse Mortgages and How Do They Work? And Credit Card Defaults Rise as Bills Come Due. And we'll begin with What Are Reverse Mortgages? A reverse mortgage is a type of home equity loan that is reserved for older homeowners and does not require monthly mortgage payments. Instead, the loan is repaid after the borrower moves out or dies. Reverse mortgages are often considered a last resort source of income, but they have become a retirement planning tool for many homeowners. The first federally insured reverse mortgage, also known as a home equity conversion mortgage or HECM, was introduced in 1989. These loans allow people who are 62 or older to tap a portion of their home equity. Stephen Sass, research economist at the Center for Retirement Research in Boston College, says a reverse mortgage makes sense for people who don't plan to move, can afford the cost of maintaining their home, want to access the equity in their home to supplement their income, or have money available for a rainy day. Some people even use a reverse mortgage to eliminate their existing mortgage and improve their monthly cash flow, says Peter Bell, president and CEO of the National Reverse Mortgage Lenders Association, or NRMLA. There's a lot of motivations leading into it, Bell says. In some cases, people may have an immediate need to pay off debt, or they may have had some unexpected expenses like a home repair or health care situation. Here are the basics. How does it work? The bank makes payments to the borrower based on a percentage of accumulated home equity. When does it need to be repaid? When the borrower dies, sells the home, or permanently moves out. Who is eligible? Seniors age 62 and older who own homes outright or have small mortgages. How can the money be used? For any reason. Retirees typically use cash to supplement income, pay for health care expenses, pay off debt, or finance home improvement jobs. If the balance is less than the value of your home at the time of repayment, you or your heirs keep the difference. How much can you get? Several factors determine the amount of funds you are eligible to receive through a reverse mortgage, including age or the age of the younger spouse in the case of couples, value of home, interest rate, lesser of appraised value or the Federal Housing Administration's HECM mortgage limit of $636,150. To be eligible for a reverse mortgage, you must either own your home outright or have a low mortgage balance that can be paid off at the closing with proceeds from the reverse loan. You must also use the home as your primary residence. A few caveats. Fees and other closing costs can be high. Borrower must maintain the house and pay property taxes and homeowner's insurance. A reverse mortgage can complicate one's wish to keep the house in the family. who wouldn't benefit? A reverse mortgage wouldn't be the best option if you can't keep up with maintenance and the other costs associated with the home, even without a monthly mortgage payment. If you die or the home is no longer the primary residence for more than 12 months, the loan comes due, which means either you or the estate has the option to repay the loan or put the home up for sale to settle it. Cost and risk. If you decide to proceed with a loan, you can expect to pay higher than average closing cost based on the value of your home, including origination fees, upfront mortgage insurance, and appraisal fees. The interest rate you pay is also generally higher than that for a traditional mortgage. Keep in mind that anyone who takes out a reverse mortgage remains responsible for paying property taxes, insurance, and repairs on their home. If you fail to comply, you may be required to repay your reverse mortgage early. Spending the equity in your home, of course, also diminishes the value of your estate, leaving you less to pay along to your heirs down the road. Always explore all other sources of income first before tapping into your home equity, said Philip Cook, a CFP professional in Manhattan Beach, California. Liquidate your portfolio and cut down on your living expenses. If you still don't have enough, a reverse mortgage may make sense. Next, credit card defaults rise as bills come due. Americans are defaulting on their credit cards at the highest rate in nearly a year. Experts blame the improving economy. Consumers are feeling more confident in their overall financial situations, and they're loosening their purse strings because of it. That confidence led to higher retail sales through the holiday season, but the credit card bills are coming due, and people are leaving them unpaid at an alarming rate, according to S&P and Experian. Another factor in the uptick in default rates is the increased willingness of financial institutions to extend credit to those who may struggle to pay it back. Nationwide, the default rate was 0.91% in December. Chicago had the highest default index value of any U.S. city at 1.15. It's a tough time of year to pay down debt because holiday dues are due, but many families are also planning for spring and summer vacations, said Michael Foguth, founder of the Foguth Financial Group in Brighton, Michigan. Foguth believes that more Americans are prioritizing vacations due to improving confidence about the economy and spending more on smaller indulgences like eating out. But the desire for date nights or a week-long retreat is often too rich for consumers' budgets, he said. The reality is, if your paycheck doesn't support your spending, you're going to default, he said. Foguth thinks social media has enhanced our desire to keep up with the Joneses, another reason we're spending money we can't afford. I call it the Vegas syndrome, he said. People always tell you how fun their vacation was, but they don't tell you how much money they lost. But it's not just an improving economy or the thrill of a getaway that is leading more people to rack up debt they can't pay. Another reason for rising credit card defaults, observers say, is that banks are loosening lending standards and making it easier for people to get more credit. Consumers have taken advantage of that trend, run up their balances, and run into trouble. A lot of the borrowers who are opening up lines of credit now are subprime. Those with bad or limited credit history or low credit scores, noted Bruce McClary, spokesman for the National Foundation for Credit Counseling, an organization that provides access to financial counseling services. I don't think we're ready to sound the crisis alarm right now, but it's certainly something that deserves our attention, he said, of the rising defaults. Subprime borrowers generally pay higher interest rates, so it tends to take them longer to pay back debt. And McCleary said credit card interest rates should go up this year as the Federal Reserve raises the key federal funds rate, which could make it even more difficult for borrowers paying higher interest rates to keep payments on time. It's really important not to let things fall far behind, he said. Missing even one payment can hurt you. The result can be a higher interest rate, late fees of at least $25, and a possible hit to your credit score, he said. Missing credit card payments can be especially dangerous for consumers, he said, because credit card companies can move quickly to impose penalties. It's not like a traffic violation where you get a warning, McCleary said. McCleary recommends seeking help from a credit counselor as early as possible, a service that can be found in every major city at low or no cost, he said. If you're well down the road to default, Foguth reminds or recommends trying to negotiate a lower interest payment plan with a credit card company or even an interest-free period. Credit card companies have an incentive to work with consumers, he said, because if they don't pay their bills, the debt will be sold to a debt collector, a scenario in which credit card companies only recoup pennies on the dollar. And the most drastic step that Foguth recommends when credit card debt gets extreme? Weigh the option of letting them all go, he said, closing cards while negotiating a payment plan for the balance due may be the only smart move left. And next, anti-smoking plan may kill cigarettes but save big tobacco. Imagine if cigarettes were no longer addictive and smoking itself became almost obsolete. Only a tiny segment of Americans still lit up. That's the goal of an unprecedented anti-smoking plan being carefully fashioned by U.S. health officials. But the proposal from the Food and Drug Administration could have another unexpected effect, opening the doors for companies to sell a new generation of alternative tobacco products, allowing the industry to survive, even thrive, for generations to come. The plan puts the FDA at the center of a long-standing debate over so-called reduced-risk products, such as e-cigarettes, and whether they should have a role in anti-smoking efforts, which have long focused exclusively on getting smokers to quit. This is the single most controversial and, frankly, divisive issue I've seen in my 40 years studying tobacco control policy, said Kenneth Warner, professor emeritus at University of Michigan School of Public Health. The FDA plan is twofold. Drastically cut nicotine levels in cigarettes so that they are essentially non-addictive. For those who can't or won't quit, allow lower-risk products that deliver nicotine without the deadly effects of traditional cigarettes. This month, the government effort is poised to take off. The FDA is expected to soon begin what will likely be a years-long process to control nicotine in cigarettes. And next week, the agency will hold a public meeting on a closely watched cigarette alternative from Philip Morris International, which, if granted FDA clearance, could launch as early as February. The product called IQOS, pronounced IQOS, is a pen-like device that heats Marlboro-branded tobacco but stops short of burning it, an approach that Philip Morris says reduces exposure to tar and other toxic byproducts of burning cigarettes. This is different from e-cigarettes, which don't use tobacco at all, but instead vaporize liquid, usually containing nicotine. For anti-smoking activists, these new products may mean surrendering hopes of a knockout blow to the industry. They say there is no safe tobacco product, and the focus should be on getting people to quit. But others are more open to the idea of alternatives to get people away from the cigarettes, the deadliest form of tobacco. Tobacco companies have made claims about safer cigarettes since the 1950s, all later proven false. In some cases, the introduction of these products, such as filtered and low-tar cigarettes, propped up cigarette sales and kept millions of Americans smoking. Although the adult smoking rate has fallen to an all-time low of 15%, smoking remains the nation's leading preventable cause of death and illness, responsible for about 1 in 5 U.S. deaths. Anti-smoking groups also point to Big Tobacco's history of manipulating public opinion and government efforts against smoking. In 2006, a federal judge ruled that Big Tobacco had lied and deceived the American public about the effects of smoking for more than 50 years. The industry defeated a 2010 proposal by the FDA to add graphic warning labels to cigarette packs, and FDA scrutiny of menthol-flavored cigarettes used disproportionately by young people and minorities has been bogged down since 2011 due to legal challenges. We're not talking about an industry that is legitimately interested in saving lives here, said Erica Schward of the America Lung Society. But some industry observers say this time will be different. The environment has changed, the technology has changed, the companies have changed. That's the reality, said Scott Balin, a health policy consultant who previously worked for the American Heart Association. Under a 2009 law, the FDA gained authority to regulate certain parts of the tobacco industry, including nicotine and cigarettes, though it cannot remove the ingredient completely. The same law allows the agency to scientifically review and permit sales of new tobacco products, including e-cigarettes. Little has happened so far. Last year, the agency said it would delay the deadline for manufacturers to submit their vapor-emitting products for review until 2022. The FDA says it wants to continue to help people quit by supporting a variety of approaches, including new quit smoking aids and opening opportunities for a variety of companies, including drug makers, to help attack the problem. As part of this, the FDA sees an important role for alternative products, but in a world where cigarettes contain such a small amount of nicotine that they become unappealing even to lifelong smokers. We still have to provide an opportunity for adults who want to get access to satisfying levels of nicotine, but without the hazards of burning tobacco, said FDA Commissioner Dr. Scott Gottlieb. He estimates the FDA plan could eventually prevent 8 million smoking-related deaths. Philip Morris International and its U.S. partner Altria will try to navigate the first few steps of the new regulatory path next week. At a two-day meeting before the FDA, company scientists will try and convince government experts that IQOS is less harmful than cigarettes because IQOS works with real tobacco. The company believes it will be more effective than e-cigarettes in getting smokers to switch. Philip Morris already sells the product in about 30 countries, including Canada, Japan, and the United Kingdom. IQOS is part of the elaborate corporate makeover for Philip Morris, which last year rebranded its website with the slogan, "Designing a Smoke-Free Future." The cigarette giant says it has invested over $3 billion in IQOS and eventually plans to stop selling cigarettes worldwide, though it resists setting a deadline. Matthew Myers of the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids still sees danger. He says FDA must strictly limit marketing of products like IQOS to adult smokers who are unable or unwilling to quit. Otherwise, they may be used in combination with cigarettes or even picked up by non-smokers or young people who might see the new devices as harmless enough to try. And next, Civic Tech opens up government data for the public good. Fostering transparency in government is a growing priority for communities across North Carolina. Within this context, there are promising efforts underway across the state to help local governments use public data effectively through Civic Tech. But as with any pioneering field, there are important lessons being learned that can help shape how North Carolina communities and their citizens can best leverage this data to maximize government's efficacy and impact. John Stevens at the UNC School of Government recently produced a report that is designed to help us collectively navigate this terrain. According to Stevens, the basic definition of civic technology is the use of open data by people outside of government to create new software applications or presentations of the data for public benefit. The first generations of technology, for example, were largely a one-way street. Government had the information and would tell us what we needed to know. Since 2010, that has begun to become more of a two-way conversation. Today, there are six different civic groups across North Carolina that have been working for more than 2 years to foster civic-minded digital innovation. There are also a growing number of larger cities and counties across the state that have created open data portals to promote civic tech projects. To be considered open data must be available to everyone in a form that is easily readable by computers so that it can be accessed and modified. By making its data openly available, governments can encourage civic innovators to develop useful applications. An oft-cited example is when the federal government made its satellite and weather data publicly available, resulting in a wave of new technologies like mapping software and weather apps that transformed our lives. But the field of civic tech has mushroomed to include activities like peer-to-peer sharing of resident-owned goods and services. Imagine a neighborhood tool-sharing service. Crowd-funded platforms to improve public spaces and services, i.e. raising money for a local park, place-based networks and community forums, and platforms to increase volunteerism and civic engagement. According to an IDC Government Insights report, civic tech made up almost a quarter of the $25.5 billion that local and state governments spent on technology in 2015, and growing 14 times faster than spending on traditional technology. Wake County, for instance, is investing in a set of open data strategies that include improving opportunities for community interactions, integration with consumer applications, portal and data expansion, and internal engagement with data owners. But these investments only pay off if there is civic engagement on the other end. This is where Code for Raleigh comes in, a brigade of local volunteers that help bridge the gap between local government and the tech community. In 2015, brigade members helped access the City of Raleigh's Budget Explorer that attempts to simplify explanations about how tax money is spent. It is now working with county commissioners to align civic app projects with county priorities. Code for Raleigh also helps organize the annual CityCamp NC Conference. North Carolina Datapalooza coordinates regional efforts with Code for Cary and Code for Durham Brigades, and is part of OpenNC, a platform to promote communication and collaboration across the state's six brigades, including the Triad, Asheville, and Charlotte. Code for Charlotte describes its work as a volunteer fire brigade for the 21st century. We use technology and advocacy as a tool for open government, open data, and civic engagement. We work with our local government and community to use design, technology, and open data to transform our city. This includes working with the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department to help organize a digital platform facilitating the distribution of Christmas gifts to more than 1,700 children and the city's finance department to improve a text message system for food stamp beneficiaries. While promising the full potential of civic tech will only be realized if important questions are addressed, such as who is ultimately responsible for developing and maintaining these platforms, how can we align the culture of civic innovators and rapid prototyping with the cautious nature of government bureaucracy? How can we evaluate what works and then replicate solutions to other communities? And how can we expand these efforts beyond just our major metros, especially to often under-resourced smaller cities and rural communities? By Stevens' estimates, less than 20% of North Carolina is benefiting from civic tech. His report makes clear that we've made a good start, and we still have a long way to go. And this is from Christopher Gergen's column. He's CEO of the Forward Forward Cities, a founding partner of HQ Community, and author of Life Entrepreneurs, Ordinary People Creating Extraordinary Lives. Also, Stephen Martin is a chief of staff at the Nonprofit Center for Creative Leadership in Greensboro. They can be reached at authors@forwardimpact.info and followed on Twitter through @cgergen. We've run out of time for today's episode of Money Matters. I hope you've enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Pat Perry, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's reading of Money Matters is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.